Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Today I continue my series on the decline of middle income paying jobs in America and, importantly, what to do about it. Last week my guest was Jaron Lanier. He advocates something called micropayments for all of us who do all this contribution to the knowledge economy without getting paid. Got some concerns about that. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But today I've got James B. Huntington. He is the author of a book called Work's New Age, which actually won the 2012 Independent Publishers Award, and it documents the demise of jobs in America. And he's written another book called Choosing a Lasting Career, and that book predicts what good jobs will remain viable. So, James B. Huntington, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Marty, it's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Good. Well, you claim that the decline in good jobs is not cyclical, that it is permanent. Make the case.
Yes, there are three major reasons why it is permanent this time. They are automation, the role of machines and computer systems, which have been replacing jobs really over 50 or 60 years steadily, and globalization, which is the role of other countries and workers outside the United States who are getting increasingly able and ready to take over American jobs for a lot less money. And efficiency, the one-way process where businesses determine easier and less resource-intensive way of getting these things done. And all three of these are moving in only one direction. That we're not going to find out in a year or two that we're all using TRS-80 computers again or something like that. There's no chance of that.
Well, the classic argument is that automation net creates jobs. So what happens is if you automate something and or you make something available inexpensively like software, which doesn't, you know, it takes a lot of effort to make the first piece of software, but then you can copy them virtually unlimited for free, that eventually the lower cost of items puts more money in people's pockets, and that enables them to buy more things and perhaps start businesses. So, you know, automation's been going on since the Stone Age, where you had a wheel that was going to enable people, instead of carrying everything on their back, to carry it on a cart. Do you have any reason to believe that automation's actually going to cost jobs net?
Yes, it's just simply the way computer systems and robots work is they replace more people than the jobs they create. They make things so much easier. The amount of products people have are less.
Okay, we've lost him. We'll try to get him back. So let me do that. Joanne, you want to come in here and get his number? Thank you. Okay, so while we're waiting to get him back, we'll try to fill the time here with some tips and things. So, okay. Well, certainly, here is the phone number, Joanne. The first number there. Thank you. Certainly, when we continue to see again and again about violence, domestic and international, people, mass shootings of various sorts, the uprisings in Syria, the chemical weapons, the terrorist Kenya event, it is a useful reminder that, unfortunately, one of the things that without question is true is that there are always going to be jobs related to security and trying to prevent terrorism of various sorts. It's not so much the big battleship war type thing so much, but I do invite you who, for yourself or your child, are looking for a new career and want one that is going to be clearly recession-proof, is not going to be automated, per what my guest said. I invite you to think of the widest range. Don't just think about, you know, the latest, you know, so now we hear about chemical weapons, so you're going to be a chemical weapons expert. Sure, that's fine. But I'm going to quickly tick off a dozen or so, all of these niches that exist, and think about if any piques your interest, or that of perhaps some family member who's looking for a career. So, for example, there's the member of the Boston Bomber. It wasn't long ago. So, you know, how do we learn how to be, and it's a dirty word, but profiler, to reduce the risk of somebody? It's not just random. How do we, without violating people's privacy unduly, how do we profile people? Then we have the... for example, we keep hearing about the Chinese military doing espionage, especially cybersecurity espionage. How do we protect our banking system, our private secrets, food supply? There are experts in terrorism prevention regarding our food supply. All it takes is somebody to inject an orange with a syringe of some communicable waterborne biovirus, and we could be killing lots of people. Or the water supply. I jog around the Lafayette Reservoir every day, and that's that beautiful big lake that people boat on all the time. All somebody needs to do on their little boat is drop a little virus, some communicable waterborne biovirus, in that, and voila, thousands of people could be killed. There's all kinds of bioweapons. There's cryptography, the ability to break codes, which is, of course, what has often been done to foil a number of the terrorist attacks that have occurred in the Middle East. There are conventional bomb specialists, bomb detection specialists. There are people involved in infrastructure preparedness. There is, of course, nuclear and radiologic devices. A suitcase nuke can be you drive into Manhattan and sit on Times Square or down here at Union Square, and you simply detonate a nuclear or radiological device. What else? Before we go back to we do have the call. We do have my guest on the line, but I want to finish this while we're at it. Of course, there are all of the airports and the seaports and the trains and buses that are vulnerable targets. There are experts who specialize in that. Arenas. Driving here, Candlestick Park is going to be a football game. And clearly, with 50,000 people there or more in a large venue, that's a terrorist, a vulnerable spot. Then there's whole medical preparedness. What happens to in the event of a terrorist attack or an earthquake, or not just in terrorists, some crazy person who is apparently this guy who shot up the Navy Yard in D.C. had mental illness problems. You know, how do we deal with mass shootings, terrorist or otherwise? Then there are public information people who are simply trying to communicate effectively to prevent and deal with mass killings of one sort or another. And you don't think about things like insurance. Every company has terrorist insurance. Being an expert in that can be a niche that you never would have thought of. You want to simply Google the term federal counterterrorism jobs. That's going to get you to an overall umbrella link. Also, every state has some sort of an Office of Homeland Security, and major police departments have intelligence and counterterrorism. So anyway, I just wanted to, while we were waiting for my guest to come back, that is certainly a huge, unfortunate, but huge pocket of opportunity for anybody who's looking for a career that is not automatable, that is not offshoreable, and is certainly recession-proof. And now I'm glad we got you back. James B. Huntington, sorry we lost you. Hopefully we will not lose you again. So are you back with us, Jim?
I am back, yes. And you made a very good point about the terrorism. It's a point I've made a number of times that the next 9/11, so to speak, will probably have nothing to do with airplanes, that it may be shopping malls or stadiums or Las Vegas or something like that.
Right. Okay, so let's turn to some of the other let's turn right away to solutions. We agree that in general, that notwithstanding my comment about perhaps technology will create more jobs, the difference may be this time that while a thresher machine may have cost a few thousand jobs. Now, when you have automated manufacturing, whether it be 3D printers, where anybody with a printer, instead of putting ink in the inkjets, they're going to have these various plastics, and there likely will be this massive automation that's going to kill millions of jobs. And in a knowledge-based economy, so much of the gross domestic product is simply sharing of information, that may indeed result in a massive dislocation of jobs, especially in a global economy, and especially with the cost of hiring people so great. So let's turn to solutions right away. There are solutions that are often proposed, like raising the minimum wage as a way of refilling the hollowed out middle class. What do you think about that and other commonly recommended cures for the hollowing out of the middle class?
That one's no good because it will cost jobs. It's just a matter of how many jobs it will cost.
Why?
Minimum wage positions such as fast food are too far away from middle class anyway. I mean, fast food workers are asking for the minimum wage to go up to $10 or $12, even $15 an hour, but none of that is going to get even a future version of middle class. It's just not close enough.
Yeah. But some would say that corporations can afford to, they've got deep pockets, and for example, as the fast food workers have been trying hard to double the minimum wage, and they say that corporations are reporting record profits, and so that ultimately that's the most direct way to hollow out the middle class. Why not?
No, because for one thing, the examples that always get chosen are the McDonald's and the Walmarts that are very large, very profitable. You don't hear about Joe's hamburger stand down the street where he's paying people the dead minimum wage and barely paying his bills. The largest companies that have a lot of low-paid workers would do relatively well if they were forced to pay them substantially more, but a whole string of other companies will not.
I always like to take the other side. So the other side is if the government mandated a true living wage for all workers, including even just for the large companies, the McDonald's and the like, that's going to create greater incentive to do, for example, what the Japanese do. The Japanese have done away with most fast food workers. It's all done automated. You place your order on it just by pushing a touch screen, and robots, basically make the food and serve it to you. Would that not ultimately be a short-term big win for the workers, of course, but long-term it would create additional incentive for the McDonald's of the world to invest in robotization and thereby eliminating all the jobs?
Of course it would, but there would be fewer jobs, simply. Our problem now is, our major problem is that we are, at last count, according to my figures, 21 million jobs short in this country. 21 million jobs would be easily absorbed. That is a lot worse of a problem than the jobs that are paying less.
Yeah. Well,
it will also create another kind of inequality. People who on the left are always talking about inequality and how pay is equal. Well, you're going to have the kind of inequality you have now in Europe, and that's going to be between people who are working and the people who only want to have jobs.
You know, you actually propose quite a liberal solution, which you say that far better than raising the minimum wage is guaranteed income. It would cost a couple of trillion dollars a year, but that's certainly redistributive in a very liberal sense. Why do you advocate a guaranteed income? In other words, taking money from the taxpayers to give those who are not earning money.
I think ultimately that is the only solution we have. There are two other possibilities that will make it through a permanent jobs crisis, and that is my thesis in Work's New Age, that the jobs crisis is permanent. One of them is higher pay for a variety of people, and the best one, really the only solution we have, the only thing that's going to work consistently, is the minimum wage. I mean, not the minimum wage, or rather, I mean, a guaranteed income where everybody will be paid. We could have shorter work hours, and we could have, as Jaron Lanier said last week, a system where people are paying and getting paid for online contributions of various sorts. Those are the other two possibilities, but I think guaranteed income is the only real possibility, and I do have ideas on how we could pay for that.
Well, let's say, I'm going to be interested in the ways you pay for it, but by definition, if you're taking $2 to $3 trillion a year out of the economy, you're taking it out of the hands of the job creators and giving it into the people who are poorest and least likely, for example, to create jobs. How do you think long-term that's a sustainable solution?
Well, that's not really the way I see it. The way it can be done, the closest to pay for it, would be to adjust corporate taxes and business taxes to account for the number of jobs that businesses are providing. For example, something in the news this past week was Darden Restaurants. You may or may not know them.
And yeah, they do Red Lobster and Olive Garden, right, yeah.
And a few other smaller chains, and they are in trouble, but they're a multi-billion dollar company, but they have over 100,000 jobs. All those restaurants are company stores. They're not franchises. Now, if you compare the contribution they're making with a company like Twitter, which last I heard had 300 employees and has a similar amount of sales every year, there's no reason why a company like Twitter, which contributes so few American jobs, should not be paying 70% or 80% of their income in taxes. And Darden, by comparison, a company like that should be paying almost nothing.
So if I'm Twitter, and let's say the government imposes a 70% or 80% corporate tax rate, I simply will move my operation to another country. There's 200 countries in the world. Why, if somebody's going to take 80% of my money away, why wouldn't I simply move? Especially if I'm a small company and I have a few companies, I just have a few employees, I can set up in some other country that's not going to charge me 70% or 80%. Won't that really ultimately cost all jobs? And what company would put up with paying a 70% corporate tax rate?
Oh, companies have paid that in many times, several other times in American history. And if you do that, if you try to move out of the country, then, well, a la Jaron Lanier, we will track which customers you have in the United States and charge you for doing business with them. That will be easy to do, and it's one way of getting out of this problem of people just stepping out of the country whenever they want to.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. We are talking about the very thorny problem, and in my heart of hearts, I'm not sold on the solutions yet discussed for how to rebuild the hollowed-out middle class. Fewer and fewer people are earning a middle-class income with middle-class wages, benefits, and reasonable job security, and I'm scared to death about it. And this show is about work, and so while I absolutely, in the second half of the show, will be helping you with your individual situation and how to survive or thrive potentially in this tough economy, I've been trying to devote a series of segments on this show to how to solve the major issue. I'm talking with James B. Huntington. He is the author of Work's New Age, as well as a book called Choosing a Lasting Career. And we are going to ask him later on in the segment about what he would do if he were looking for jobs in the short run. One of the things you talk about, and this my first reaction is I hate the idea, but I want to give you a chance to give it voice. You think that America would be better if we had a 30-hour work week instead of mandating that nobody could work except in exceptional circumstances. Almost everybody would be working no more than 30 hours a week. Make the case for that, please.
Well, I don't think it should be mandated. I don't see the idea that government would say
like
everybody
France
must clock out after working 30 weeks.
Well, France does that, 35 hours a week.
I'm talking about a standard work week. The 40-hour work week came in the 1930s. It's about 75 years old. The union said something along the lines of 8 hours of work, 8 hours of sleep, 8 hours for what we will. It was a great campaign. It went through, and government jobs and most private office jobs established that. Now, it used to be a standard stock prediction of the future that hours would come way down. People were predicting 30, 20, 10 hours a week. It didn't work out that way, mainly because of the burden of health insurance, which is per worker. It's not per hour of work. So companies want fewer workers putting in more hours. So the amount of efficiency we would have and the level of automation would allow us, if we wanted it, to have normal business hours instead of being 8 to 5 or 9 to 5, to be something like 9 to 1.
Here's my profound worry. Not everybody is equal. I know we like to say everybody's equal, but every employer, every employee knows that not all workers are equally productive, equally smart, equally low maintenance, equally enjoyable to get along with. And if we now, and it's not random who is asked to work 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week, disproportionately those are our most capable people. And I always like to use the example of the cardiologist. If a cardiologist is wonderful with patients, is terrific, he or she in hours 50, 60, and 70 is going to save more lives than if we force him to or her to work only 30 hours a week, and therefore patients must see the least, the unemployed cardiologist, the one who would not have gotten 30 hours a week otherwise. More people will die. You multiply that across the entire nation. If we force everybody to work 30 hours a week, we are lopping off the very best workers and replacing those hours with people who are our least productive people. How can that be a solution that is net good for America?
No, it's a, again, we could have, you could say that about any length of hours. You could say that
That's
people
right.
should have to work 80 hours a week and the best workers will work 120.
I didn't say have
no,
to.
There's nothing magical about 40 hours a week. It's what we've had for a long, long time. And nobody would be mandated to work. It's ordinary business hours for cubicle jobs and such other positions could be 20 hours a week at this point. As far as, I mean, not everybody is working only 40 hours a week, of course. I mean, you tell a first or second year lawyer at a big firm that they're going to be working, oh, you're only working 40 hours, right? They'll laugh in your face if they don't pop you one first. And cardiologists are working 70 or 80 hours a week, and, well, maybe it would be better for them and for their health and everything else if they were only, quote-unquote, working 50 or 60.
Some cardiologists.
No, I don't agree with any mandate that anyone has a mandatory amount. I'm just looking for the 40-hour standard, which is long overdue to be replaced, being cut down.
I could not disagree more, but let's move on to, you said you wanted to comment on Jared Lanier's idea. Jared Lanier said that all of us make contributions to the knowledge economy, to what he calls the siren servers, the Amazons and the Facebooks and the Googles, and they essentially give all of those big companies a lot of free information just by making choices about what they read, what they do, who they Facebook like, etc. And Jaron thinks that the government should set up a big set of computers that forces companies to pay every individual for that. And by his calculations, even the least among us will have contributed at least $500 a year to the knowledge economy. More typical people would contribute a few thousand. I think it seems crazy to me because I just think that accounting for all of those contributions would be a mammoth undertaking, and then there would be endless lawsuits. This lawyer would form a class action suit to say, my class of people deserve more money, my deserve less, and I think it would be a nightmare, especially when it's not like people are going to be earning middle-class livings from these micropayments. What do you think?
Oh, yes. I mean, Lanier's scheme, I liked it. I actually put it up with my short list with guaranteed income and shorter work hours as one of the few things that could work. My quarrels with it are that it just simply wouldn't be enough. He has an example in Who Owns the Future, his latest book, about somebody designing a sand bridge on a beach and getting people to pay to duplicate it, and within a few minutes he has 58 people or something around the world, and it's enough to generate a nice day's earnings, as he put it. But I think that would not be worth nearly as much, that instead of the $3 or $4 a piece that his example projects out to, I mean, I think people would be more willing to pay a dime or a quarter for something like that. Now, as far as the personal information we all provide, and we do. I mean, that was Lanier's point about siren servers, is that they pull you in with free products, and you have to give them a lot of information. Like Facebook, they know a ton about me because I've been on there a lot. Now, the data I provide is worth money to them, but it's worth nowhere near anything that would get me any kind of a living, even for only things like food and shelter. So yes, it's a good idea. It's worthy of investigation, but if you're thinking that 100 million people who use Facebook, eBay, Google, various Microsoft products, so on and so forth, are going to each earn enough to even to buy food for a month, let alone to be in the middle class, I think that's way off base.
Yeah. We were just about out of time, but I promised the listeners that we were going to, you've written one of your other books was called Choosing a Lasting Career. It's about good careers that are likely to remain viable for decades. What are some of the careers you tout, that you view as likely to be lasting and that perhaps aren't so obvious to folks?
Yes. Well, there are two areas that are especially good for careers. One of them is healthcare, because the population is aging and most health-related jobs are not going to be susceptible to robots or foreign workers or computer systems for that matter. Another one is counseling-related areas, anything from drug rehab counseling to marriage counseling. Mm-hmm. People need advice on a lot of things in life, and they will be provided really by Americans.
Let me comment about some of those. Let's talk about the healthcare. You know, we're seeing that even surgery is being done remotely and robotically. This is old news, but you know, we had many of the radiology jobs, radiologist jobs, have been shipped overseas. You have Indian radiologists who are reviewing the files, and even in terms of elder care. I've just been hearing about robotic caretakers for elders. And in terms of counseling, there is no reason in the world why the counselor has to be based here in the United States. If you're paying somebody a middle class, let's say an American corporation hires counselors, and they got to pay them a middle class wage, and they got to pay Obamacare, and they got to pay paid family leave, which is the law here in California, and they got disability and got Social Security, and they can go and they can find some other counseling person in any of the other 200 countries in the world for 70% or 80% less. Why are those really likely to be sustainable?
Well, the counseling jobs are still good because in order to understand what's going on in America, customers are going to want Americans. They can tolerate somebody from India helping them with a basic computer problem, although even that is coming up against a lot of customer resistance. But you're going to need people who understand American culture better than anyone can really be taught out of a book or a class or something.
Not so sure. You know, so many of the human issues of, you know, personal counseling of fear and anger and depression and loneliness and whatever are universals. And if somebody could get a therapist for $20 an hour instead of the American $200 an hour, I'm not so convinced that, you know, American, and remember, America is not, this is not just a monoculture. America is filled with people from very, very different cultures. So, you know, I'm not sold on the idea that even counseling is forever going to be, you know, a non-offshoreable job. You got one more career area that you think could survive my worries.
Okay, the bad jobs, a lot of things.
No, I want to hear a good one. We got to end on a positive note here. Tell me about one other good job that you think will be sustainable.
I meant people jobs that people consider bad but are going to be around for a long, long time, and those are such things as hotel maids, people preparing food, chefs, cooks. There are a lot of jobs that, like, if you buy donuts over there at the studio, they're not going to come from Cleveland, no matter how good they are. They're going to have to be made locally in America.
How about a good job?
Not a very good job, but there will be demand for donut makers in 20 years, guaranteed.
When we lost your call, I tried to fill in by talking about all the good cybersecurity, not just cybers, but all kinds of security jobs that are much better paying and more psychologically rewarding than cleaning toilets. Do you have one more good job that is potentially will pay middle class living not only now but in decades to come?
Science positions, things connected with astronomy and physics. anything connected with planning or understanding recreational space travel. That is going to be a growth area over the next 20 years, and there are not enough people who really understand the whole system of how it would work and have the vision of being able to do that. That's something where they will pay American wages if you are good enough, because there simply aren't many people anywhere in the world who can do that.
Well, James B. Huntington, I want to thank you for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. His books are Works New Age. That's also the name of his blog. If you blog Works New Age, you can read his stuff. I actually like his blog. I encourage you to take a look, and then you'll also be able to peek at some aspects of his book. Anyway, James, thanks for giving me part of your Sunday.
Thank you, Marty.
Okay. I want to do two things. I want to go to the phones for three reasons. One is, if you have any comments, I did want to interact more directly with you, and I made a choice to let James go. If you have any comments or about what James and I were talking about, what might help the middle class. By the way, you know, I just to throw things quickly out, things I've said before on this show, but I do think that more you could tell in my voice I was not enthused about his solutions, although he frankly sounded better in his blog. But I do think that we have a better chance of creating middle class jobs if we do replace 2 days a week of PE in schools, physical education, with entrepreneurship education. I think that would enable more people to be successfully self-employed, provide new needed services and products, and that would create jobs. I also have argued that we do need a WPA-like jobs program. The government does, instead of giving a government-guaranteed income, which provides no real we don't know what they're going to spend the money on, but instead we create a jobs program. Not only does that give them money, but it helps encourage a sense of self, people feeling their lives are worthwhile. And, of course, society benefits from the kind of projects that would accrue, for example, improving U.S.'s infrastructure. And finally, I also think that we also need to learn to live less materialistically. I've said that many times on the show. I think what one realizes that, as I've really argued, I think pretty dispositively on the show, one could live well on far less money than we think we need to live well. I think those are more likely to be solutions for our hollowed out middle class. But so now I welcome your comments. What do you think would help rebuild the middle class? Or what do you think about the ideas that James Huntington and I have presented? That's one reason to call. Two is, as always, I like to help you with your individual problem. So if you or someone you love is stuck work-wise, either you don't know how to deal with a problem on your current job, you don't know what you want to be when you grow up, even though you're fully grown up, or you just have any sort of, you or someone you love has some kind of work-related malaise, I can usually help you take at least a baby step forward, maybe even a big step forward. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while I'm waiting for your calls to come in, I found myself moved this morning to, when I was thinking about planning for the show, I've written my first children's story. I've written a number of books, but I've never written a children's book. And I wrote a children's book. Frankly, it was originally to deal with issues like sacrifice in a personal sense, personal sacrifice. But then, as I was planning for today's show, I thought about that it has profound implications for work. We all know how many people have literally killed themselves for their job. There's actually a term for it, I don't remember it, in Japanese, about the many, many people who've worked so hard they died of it. It's not kaizen, I can't remember the word. But anyway, I'm going to read you this story before I even go to the phones. All my lines are lighted up, so maybe I should wait. Yeah, I think that's what I'm going to do with all the lines lighted up. I think I'm going to read this at the end of the show. It's about a 3-minute story. I'll read that at the end. But for now, let's go to the phones. All the lines are lighted up. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello.
Yes, hello. Hi, Marty. This is Tim calling. Thank you for your show.
Hi, Tim.
I have a question. I am a 50-year-old male here in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and considering a job change, moving into healthcare. Mm-hmm. I've heard on your show before where you've mentioned that nursing is probably not such a good idea
anymore.
Anymore. Mm-hmm. What if I'm part of the way through?
Well, then I would say you got to specialize. You've got to focus on some niche that we know. You know, I am really excited, and I've spent for many years. I think the most rewarding job in healthcare is nurse practitioner or physician assistant. If you're partway through, I would make my goal to some niche. Either be a nurse practitioner where you really get to do 80% of what a doctor does. With far less training, or become a nurse anesthetist, or decide that you're going to specialize in home care, which is one of the things that I find not a very rewarding niche in nursing, but you might. But it certainly seems like a very viable niche. Somebody who specializes in public health nursing. I do think that we are going to face a lot of public health challenges. So I would, from right now, in terms of your fieldwork assignments, in terms of what you do your term papers on, in terms of where you try to get your job, I would encourage you to try to find a niche now so that you can become a specialist and the go-to guy. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes.
Okay.
And I appreciate your advice. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help, or what's on your mind? Hello, it's you.
Yes. Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Could you turn down your phone, please?
Absolutely.
Because it's echoing, yeah. Okay. Are you there? Okay, that's not working, so let's go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
Hi. I have a question for you. When you were speaking with James Huntington,
right.
I would have liked you to ask him about his opinion and the exact number of jobs that would be lost. I'm beginning to hear that many companies, in anticipation of Obamacare, are firing workers. A lot of the lab corporations are letting workers go. How do you think this will affect? Will that be a further erosion of job loss because companies are afraid to do not want to pay for maximum number of employees on Obamacare?
I think short term, I can't answer for Jim, but I have a pretty confident answer on this. I think short term, yes. In fact, the Cleveland Clinic said that it's cutting 400,000 jobs, not exclusively because of Obamacare, but that's one of the factors. And a number of employers are. But what I think is going to happen, remember that President Obama was not happy with Obamacare. He viewed that as a compromise, a first step, and he realized what he really wants is single payer. So what's going to happen is there are going to be a number of employers who are going to then hire a lot of people at 29 hours a week and to avoid paying Obamacare. And individuals under the individual mandate, their people are simply going to pay the fine, rather, which is a lot smaller than the insurance, which could cost $10,000 a year. But what that's going to happen, that's going to give him ammunition to say, look, the goal here is not to get people to evade paying for health insurance. So now we want every employer for 10 hours a week or instead of 30 hours a week or more have to provide it. If you're working 10 hours a week, you're going to have to provide at least proportionate. So I think the 2, 3, 5 years down the road, there will be no cost in terms of their employers will not be cutting back. The question always is the overall cost of hiring Americans so high that is what is killing jobs? But I don't think that per se that Obamacare long term is going to kill lots of jobs.
Thanks a lot, Marty.
You're welcome. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. Hello, it's you.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Morris. I am trying to have a symposium in which I would like to see many of the jobs sort of repatriated and to come to the way where we could fund citizens that is fund the infrastructure program. I mean, here in Colorado, we have the flood, and then in New Mexico, we have a drought. I mean, can't we just transfer the water over there? The Mississippi is going out the way, Florida's flooding, North Dakota flooding. We could, distribute the water around. So we need to do some infrastructure work, and I think the public should be able to fund that.
Well, I think that's probably right. I think, as I said, I think that right now the private sector, because it is so expensive to hire an American, that's why we have a jobless recovery. But I do think that that is an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars. It's not ideal, but I do think that government funding infrastructure, whether it be prevention issues or dealing with disasters, that feels like, in the end, probably a good compromise and worth doing. I thank you for the call. We've got a lot of lines lighted up. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a question about the field of physical therapy. My
sure.
husband is a physical therapist,
yep.
and if he wanted to leave his company today and get another job, he could get one immediately.
Right.
They're desperate for physical therapists. So
right.
my question is, what kind of programs are in place to get the fields that need people mm-hmm. in touch with the people who need jobs? Like, how is that? What kind of programs are in place to make that happen? Because it seems to me that physical therapy is an amazing profession.
It is.
Part of.
It's one of the best.
And it pays well.
Yes.
And it's rewarding. And so why is the field so desperate for people when there are so many people desperate for jobs?
Here's why. It was not long ago, maybe a decade or two ago, that all it required to be a physical therapist was a bachelor's degree. But there were various forces that made them up the standards. The universities loved saying, let's raise standards, because that keeps students there longer. So that first it was a master's degree. Now you need a doctorate in physical
right.
therapy. And so the universities make it harder so that fewer people have the money or the time or the ability to make it through a doctorate. Then the professional associations, the American Physical Therapy Association, also loved it. They want more prestige for their people. So they were happy to get on board and say, raise standards. So that put more pressure to have it be a doctorate requiring degree. And then third, who could be against, you know, we live in a world where we say high standards, it's like apple pie. But the reality is that there is a price that is always paid, whether it be for physical therapy, if we demand too high a level. If you look moment by moment at what physical therapists do, even though I'm well aware that physical therapy assistants and physical therapy aides do a lot of low-level work, but if you look moment by moment at what physical therapists do, how much of that doctorate-level training do they need? Very, very little. They can always consult with a small percentage of people who were doctorate level when they have a thorny problem. But most of what physical therapists do is design very simple kind of rehabilitation programs that do not require a doctorate. So the real evil here is this pressure for, quote, higher standards. Higher standards comes with a price, whether we're talking about for high school graduation, when we raised high school standards so that every student had to pass what's called the high school exit exam, the dropout rate increased 20%. Mike Kirst, the big education guru at Stanford, documented that. So high standards sounds great in theory, but one must be more nuanced than it, and that is my analysis of why there are not enough physical therapy schools.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. And it also explains why he's over $100,000 in debt. So
that's right. And the colleges love it. The colleges say, hey, we don't have to train more students. We can just keep them there longer. That way we don't have any recruitment costs, because we have the same student. Instead of for, you know, a bachelor's degree, you can have them there for their master's and their doctor of PT. They can cut down the size of their recruitment office. It's in the end, mm-hmm. it comes down to money. In a lot of ways.
It's very unfortunate. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I will
give
out the phone number again, especially if you are struggling with your work life. I don't care if you're a clerk or a CEO. You can be struggling, either practically struggling or simply struggling on a crisis of meaning. You or someone you love, any kind of work-related problem, I usually can help you get unstuck with what I call a three-minute workover. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello, it's you. Good morning.
Thank you for all that you do. I've learned so much from you.
Thank you.
Marty, I want to find a chef or someone to help me do some cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to go from the sublime to the ridiculous, but maybe you can give me some nuggets of your wisdom on doing this.
Sure.
My wife's diabetic.
Yep.
We have to use little oil,
right.
No carbs, no sugars, mm-hmm. and no added salt.
Sure.
Can you give us your best shot, Marty?
Easy peasy. There is something called the United States Professional Chef Association, which is the professional association for professional chefs. They have a database of all the local people who do that for a living. Professional chefs, they're called personal chefs. And you will find, and it may be another website, I think, called personalchef.com. I'm not sure. But there is a lot of people who are chefs, who don't want to work in a restaurant nights and weekends and work till 2 in the morning and making, you know, 50 of the same item, who love to be a personal chef. So you will have no trouble finding a personal chef. And in fact, you can be very picky. I'm sure there are personal chefs who have a lot of experience working with diabetics or people who have medical diets. The other thing, of course, you can do is that's what I would do. I mean, you'll have no trouble finding one. Just Google U.S. Professional Chef Association or personal chef and the name of the city you are in and the word diabetes, and you'll probably right away get targeted with somebody who's right on target for you.
Maury, I once heard you tell a guy who's calling someone that you should work with a person like maybe 4 hours or like half a day to get a feel for this person. Do you think that's good advice
always, no matter what? You know, it's like dating. You don't marry somebody without dating them for a while first. When you're employing somebody, you should always, if that person is at all willing, do a trial. Say, hey, we're going on a first date. Why don't you work with me on this project, whether it be 4 hours or a week or whatever? And then if we're compatible, if we're both happy with each other, then we can go on further. But, you know, making long-term commitments before you really know what it's like to work and live with each other, at least in the workplace, is misguided. It's an absolutely good idea.
I got burnt one time, so I'm gonna follow that advice.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, Maury. Thanks for everything. Bye.
Okay. You're welcome. I think I'm going to do this now. I promised that I wanted to read my first children's story that I've written. It's really for adults, but it's also for children. I think the best children's stories, just like the best Pixar movies, they can be listened to on and watched on multiple levels. A child gets one level of understanding and an adult gets another. And as I said, this one, it was originally, I wrote it to explore the issue of sacrifice and when it's worth sacrificing and not worth sacrificing. And I wasn't thinking about work, but after I wrote it, it reminded me that indeed so many people sacrifice their whole lives to work. As I said, in Japan, there is a phrase or a word for the millions of people who literally worked themselves to death. And so I'm going to read this to you in the spirit of opening a conversation, or at least opening your thinking about, is it worth the price? I will candidly tell you that I work a million hours a week, and I know I'm going to die sooner from working as hard as I do, but I've made a judgment that it's worth the price. But my way is not the only way. So this story is designed to help you think about how much sacrifice do you want to make for work. I call this, the story is called Venus and Iris. Deep in the bog, with the cicadas singing, Mama Venus flytrap no longer looked so scary. Her leaves were yellow and limp. Even her trap's jaws were limp. And even though a tasty beetle sat in one of her trap would not close. Mama's son looked up at her, worried. It's all right, my son. It's my time to return to the earth. It's your time to grow up from the earth.
Mama, please don't die,
the boy whispered. But Mama's leaves got so limp, they started to shrivel.
And remember, son, I know you love to eat, but please eat only one insect each day. More and you'll melt into the earth.
And with that, Mama melted into the earth. And the boy was sad. Very sad. And he was scared. It was his first time alone. And he worried he'd always be alone. Sure, there were many baby Venuses there, but they didn't seem to count. The boy was just old enough to start noticing things. For example, he noticed that he had 8 red traps. He thought they were kind of ugly and wished they were green like the rest of them. He also noticed things outside himself. He looked to the left, just some baby Venuses and some brush. He looked to the right, just some baby Venuses and some peat. He looked ahead, just some baby Venuses and lots of bog. But then he looked behind, and there was an iris. And it was beautiful.
It was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen. It's hard for flytraps to talk, especially young ones. But the boy summoned all his energy and croaked, "Hi." Iris stared at his traps, and even though those traps were small, those teeth, she got scared, and so she looked away. Embarrassed and sad, he turned away too. Days passed, and every so often an insect would fall into his trap, and as soon as it touched two of the trap's trigger hairs, the trap slammed shut. Well, a growing boy has to eat. And the boy grew bigger. And every so often, he would look at Iris. But the bigger he got, the scarier he looked, and the faster she turned away. So he did too. Now months passed, and now he was big. And all those baby Venuses were almost as big as he was. And then one day, there was loud buzzing. Beetles. He looked at Iris. She was covered with beetles. They were eating her. The boy widened his traps and squeezed really hard so lots of the glistening, attractive dew sat on his traps. And it worked. A beetle jumped off Iris and right onto his trap. Snap! Dinner is served. But there still were beetles, lots of beetles, all over Iris. He didn't care that she had been scared of him. He loved her. He had to try to save her. But what could he do? The beetles had chewed big holes in Iris's leaves and were making more holes faster and faster. She was starting to wilt. He had to think of something, and fast. He thought and he thought. And then he noticed the other flytraps. Yes! Even though flytraps do find it very hard to speak, love makes almost anything possible. So he tried to speak, but alas, all that came out was digested beetle. He tried again to speak, more digested beetle. He tried yet again, and finally words did come out. "Please help me save my Iris." But the flytraps didn't move. "Please," he cried. Still, the flytraps remained still. He screamed, "I love her more than life itself." And that moved the flytraps. Suddenly, most of them squeezed as hard as they could, and their traps opened as wide as they could, and their traps were covered with that glistening, attractive dew. And like a magnet, the beetles jumped into the traps. Well, most of the beetles. Exhausted, all the other flytraps fell asleep. But two beetles were still left on Iris. Now what? The boy couldn't eat him himself. He had just eaten one and remembered what his mama had warned him. Eat more than one in a day and you'll die. But the boy looked at Iris, and he knew what he had to do. He squeezed harder than he ever had in his entire life. And then he squeezed some more. And all his traps opened, the widest they'd ever been, even wider than you do when the doctor tells you to say, "Ah." And all his traps were completely covered with that glistening, attractive dew. And just like that, the two beetles jumped from Iris and into his traps. Snap! Snap! The boy looked at Iris and he was happy. And this time, she did not look away. She leaned toward him, and the boy was very happy. But then the boy felt sick, and he wondered, "Should I have eaten those beetles?" And the boy's red traps turned green, a sickly green. Would you have eaten the beetles? Iris knew that if she used her body to shield the boy from the sun for 2 days, he would live. But she, who can live only in shade, would likely die. If you were Iris, what would you do? And that's the story of Venus and Iris, a study in the question of sacrifice. What is worth sacrificing for even your life? And although the story explicitly is about sacrificing for love, as I said, millions of people sacrifice their health, their relationships, indeed their whole life, because of work. I've made the unpopular personal choice to do that. Cosmically, my sense of what the meaning of the life well led is about being as productive as possible, even when your life is out of balance. But that is not the only choice. It's obviously one of the most intimate choices we make in life. And so I use that as a trigger. If we have time for one or maybe two calls, if you have a thought about the role of sacrifice and how much is it worth sacrificing for productivity and for work, I invite you to call. We have the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And no sooner did I give out the phone number than we do have callers on the line. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I hear you wonderfully.
Yes. Thank you very much. I was curious, you described the sacrifices or the choices that you've made. I was interested in knowing what things you've given up in terms of maybe contact with grandchildren family or whatever.
Exactly.
For the sake of your work.
It's remarkable that you ask the question because it's so timely. I just said my wife went last night to go to D.C. to take a few days off to be with the grandkids. I clearly could have done the same thing, and I made the choice to not. So you're exactly that kind of stuff. Going to see the grandkids, going to somebody's bar mitzvah in Topeka, watching TV, playing golf, playing sitcoms, playing video games, laughing, going to parties. I forego, frankly, almost all of that. I only go with my wife when she requires me as part of her social responsibilities as superintendent of schools. I work literally every moment I'm awake. I know that's, but you've asked the question. That is my honest answer.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Anyway, so I want to close by simply inviting you, and I really know this is not preaching. There is certainly most of the wisdom of the ages talks about the importance of balance. Most modern experts talk about the importance of balance. But many people in practice make greater or lesser sacrifices for work or for productivity. And I invite you at least to be conscious. Sometimes we make these decisions unconsciously, and we just go through life. So I can, with some confidence, say, I urge you to make conscious decision about how is your life best led? How much of it is work? How much of it is balance? How much of it is recreation, creativity, family, etc.? And on that note, that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers, and I'll talk with the former California EDD director, Michael Burnick, about how the media portrayals of work reveal the realities of work, but also distort them. I find him a fascinating guy. Plus, you can certainly call in for a 3-minute workover. We'll make sure we have plenty of time for that. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.